Welcome. I'm Avery.
And I'm Grace Ann. And this is Drift, a podcast exploring stories and science of Barnegat Bay's past, present, and future.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Drift, the podcast. It's me, Avery.
I'm Grace Ann.
Thanks for tuning in again. We are very excited about this week's episode. We are launching into our NEMO or Stormwater month for the podcast. So NEMO stands for Non-Point Education for Municipal Officials, which is a fancy term for our Stormwater Initiative, which is a grant-funded program here at Save Barnegat Bay, but is something that extends well past that as part of our just kind of general mission doing work here in the watershed. So this episode and the next will feature topics on stormwater, and we are very excited today to feature two of our guest speakers who will be part of an upcoming seminar series on stormwater and all the nitty-gritty details of management and statewide issues and bringing it down to local issues as well. This is the first installment of that series. We'll have a seminar coming up again on June 2nd and then some more free educational opportunities after that.
We have so much coming up in the way of our project here for NEMO. So, you know, we have these two podcast episodes, we have a webinar coming up, we've got some rain barrel workshops, and we even have more workshops that are on deck with other towns that aren't scheduled yet. So definitely stay tuned for our podcast information, but also our newsletter, both the electronic newsletter, the paper newsletter, and our social media sites.
So we're super excited, as I said, to feature our two guests today, Chris Abrupta and Steve Souza, who are our two stormwater experts, and just kind of a lead in to hearing some of their wisdom and expertise. We wanted to break down some key terms or buzzwords in the stormwater conversation that you might hear come up in all of this, just to give you kind of a basis of understanding of what this quite complex conversation is all about. So Grace Ann and I have some of the stormwater for dummies terms here for you.
But don't worry, we don't think you're dummies. We just understand that this jargon is a lot of stuff that everyone in their day-to-day doesn't necessarily interact with this vocab. So we want to make sure that we are communicating in the best way possible so that everyone feels included. I'd like to define the first word that you might not have understood, non-point. That's actually in the acronym of the NEMO project. Non-point is the first word. And that's pollution that we can't point to the source of. So whereas in, you know, large factories or large polluting entities, for instance, you can point to them and say, you know, this thing is coming out of this building.
Like a smokestack, for example.
Sure. A smokestack could definitely be a good example. However, with non-point source pollution, it's the accumulation of pollution coming from all different areas, and it's really kind of hard to pinpoint where it's coming from. So in the context that we're going to talk about it today, it's really coming from property owners all across the watershed, both private, public spaces, whatever that is, and stuff being put on the land is moving around the watershed and ending up in our waterways, and it's hard to figure out where it's coming from. In the case of stormwater, it's really just us talking about rain and snow, really. So any precipitation from the sky, basically rain or snow, is considered stormwater. So every time we say stormwater, that's all we mean. And then when stormwater moves across these hard surfaces, that then turns into runoff. So hard surfaces can be anything from roads, sidewalks, roofs, parking lots, driveways, grass lawns, all these surfaces that do not allow water to pass through them. When all these hard surfaces carry stormwater via runoff into our waterways, it can create an impaired waterway.
So impaired waters just refer to any body of water, collection of water that doesn't meet a safe standard in the state. So we have something called the Clean Water Act, which is a federal act, oversees the level of safe pollution or lack of pollution in water bodies. And so if a water body is impaired, it's not meeting that level, meaning it could be too highly polluted or damaged or compromised to the point where it is no longer safe for human health reasons. And so impaired waters receive certain considerations to either improve those water quality standards or address them in some way, or just kind of put an asterisk next to them saying that we know they're not meeting them. We're kind of setting this aside as an area that might not be safe for that reason.
And impaired waters is really a very deep hole to dive into. So just to kind of preface that, that issue is really complicated and it's not as simple as we're making it in a, you know, 10 second definition of what it means.
Yeah, it's the basis of a lot of our state codes and local codes and federal regulations and stuff like that. But for the purpose of kind of understanding the stormwater conversation, it's just linking it to unsafe or polluted or compromised water.
Yeah. And so one of the ways that water can be impaired is if it's eutrophied or affected by eutrophication. A body of water has too much nutrients in it. It has an excess of nutrients. And to clarify, nutrients is found in waterways all the time. It's actually what supports life and the food cycle and all the things. But when we have too much of anything in any system, it's going to cause an imbalance. Algae grows to an abundance, or bacteria can grow to an abundance. And there's all kinds of domino effect that happen due to eutrophication. And finally, one of the words that we use throughout the podcast today is going to be watershed. The land sheds water. So a watershed is all the land area that sheds water into a near body of water. And so that water can be rainwater or stormwater. It can be rivers, creeks, and streams, and it can also be, in our case, groundwater. So in the Barnegat Bay watershed, which starts up at the headwaters of the Toms River and the Matitaconk River in the northwest corner over by Six Flags Great Adventure, all the water from there drains east into Barnegat Bay and then into the ocean. No matter where you are on the planet, you're always standing in a watershed. And so that's a really important concept to understand, because if we're going to talk about stormwater and its implications of carrying pollution into nearby waterways, you have to understand where the land area has boundaries that are going to impact where the stormwater moves.
And this is an important concept as well, because it underscores the fact that we are all linked to stormwater. We all live in a watershed, no matter where you are on Earth, whether it's in the Barnegat Bay one or not. And that means that the actions that you take part in on land affect something that ends up in a collecting water body.
So welcome, Steve and Chris. Thank you so much for joining us today on our podcast. We have today two stormwater experts from around the state of New Jersey, and I will ask them to introduce themselves and their experience working with stormwater and the entities that they're currently serving. So why don't we start with Steve?
Hi. Yeah, I'm Steve Souza. I'm the owner of Clean Waters Consulting, and previously I was the founder and president of Princeton Hydro from its inception until I retired in 2018. I primarily do a lot of education and outreach through Rutgers University and Temple University on stormwater related issues, particularly, you know, promoting the use of green infrastructure as a way to mitigate water quality problems, as well as flooding, localized flooding problems.
So I'm Chris Abrupta. I'm with Rutgers University. I'm what they call the extension specialist for Rutgers Cooperative Extension in water resources. I also teach in the environmental science department, where I teach environmental engineering. I'm also the director of the New Jersey Water Resources Research Institute here at Rutgers. I've been at Rutgers about 20 years. And before that, I was an environmental consultant for 12 years, competing with Steve and his company. And he drove me out of business and sent me to the university. So that's why I'm here.
We're so happy to have you both on our podcast today. We love hearing expert voices on the things that we're talking about and kind of zoom around the watershed and across the state to speak with professionals to get some more details on what's going on with our initiatives. So Chris and Steve are both working with us on our NEMO project, which is a fancy sounding title essentially for our stormwater initiative that we're working on, that has to do with components of education and advocacy outreach.
the work that Save Barnegat Bay has been doing for the past decade or so has all centered around stormwater or been leading to stormwater. NEMO's grant itself, where we got money from the DEP to support this initiative, has been going on for about a year or so. So we still have another year or two left of this grant. But the work we do at Save Barnegat Bay encompasses all the time. It involves relationships with all 37 towns that drain into Barnegat Bay. And all the municipalities of, and then of course the county, and then of course the state.
So to kind of kick off the conversation here from a zoomed out lens, why is proper management of stormwater such a critical issue at the Jersey Shore?
You know, this is on a national scale, but just in 2021 alone, we had 18 weather disasters in the U.S. That resulted in over $1 billion worth of damages. And that was reported in the Washington Post, but it's, you know, reflective of data collected by NOAA last year. And since 1980, I know it's a long time span, but since 1980, there's been over $1 trillion of impact to property losses, loss of, businesses, et cetera. Again, related directly to flooding and impacts associated with stormwater runoff. So, you know, when you think of it from the economic scale, it's pretty, you know, eye-opening, the types of problems that we're having. And, you know, the projections are by 2051, we're going to see even more significant storms, and you know, these problems are going to be more impactful. And the thing is, you know, New Jersey does have a lot of properties that are in flood prone areas, and not just the coast. You know, we saw during, you know, Hurricane Ida that even interior portions of New Jersey, like right here where I live in East Stanwell, subject to catastrophic flooding, loss of life, loss of property, etc. So these are real problems, you know, and it's in things that need to be addressed. We just can't kind of look the other way and say, well, you know, it's just a little bit of rain. It's a little bit of runoff. No, it's not.
So, I mean, I'd like to take us back to 1972 when Richard Nixon signed the Clean Water Act. At that point, the United States, about 60% of our waterways were impaired, you know, not meeting water quality standards. And here we are 50 years later, and we still have about 50% of our waterways are not impaired. What's very interesting, I started Rutgers in 2002, started working here, and about 95% of New Jersey waterways were impaired at that point. And here we are 20 years later, and we still have about 95% of our waterways are impaired in the state. We've had a lot of development over that time and increased a lot more, a lot higher population. About 750,000 people moved into New Jersey over that time period. So we haven't gotten any worse, but we haven't gotten any better. So that's one thing we really need to kind of focus on is how do we go back and turn the clock back and try to figure out how to improve our efforts so we can actually make our waterways cleaner and better. You know, getting back to some of the things that Steve said about Hurricane Ida, you know, we lost 30 lives in New Jersey in Hurricane Ida, and that's the most we've lost since 1990 or since 1900. So it was a huge storm, and also between $16 to $24 billion in damages in the Northeast. So very significant, and trying to figure out how do we do a better job of that, because we're expecting due to climate change that we will see more Idas in our future.
The issue of stormwater is so complex and far-reaching. But part of perhaps our mission in all of this is connecting individual homeowners, private citizens, municipal leaders with the issue and how it affects their lives. And so really, we're all connected to stormwater in some way. It affects, as Steve mentioned, the economic output of our state, our human health and safety, our local communities and culture is all tied to issue of stormwater. And so I'm curious how we can harness this knowledge to see stormwater as a resource, you know, because when it comes down from the sky, it's not inherently bad unless you consider something like acid rain pollution or something like that.
But when it begins to pick up things like pollutants or begins to cause problems of flooding and stuff like that, that's when we need to manage it in a certain way. How can these different levels of people feel connected to the issue of stormwater?
We started thinking about private citizens and when it rains, the water is important. I mean, we love our landscapes, we love our lawns, and we like when things are green and growing, and it really improves our quality of life. Coming out of the gloomy winter into the spring, how great you feel when that first day you can walk outside and everything's starting to turn green, everything's starting to bloom. And that becomes really, really important for who we are as a society. I think what we're seeing now is like last year, I think New Jersey got something like 49 inches of rain. We are a very water-rich state. But what we're seeing now with the climate change is that we're starting to get more intense storms followed by longer periods of drought. So we'll get a heavy rainfall on a Monday, and then it may not rain for 2 or 3 weeks afterwards. So we're going to see more of that in the future. And we have to begin thinking about how are we going to be able to harvest that rainwater when it comes and use it, save it, so we can maintain our landscapes and our quality of life that we're so accustomed to in New Jersey. So I think that's what we're trying to get people to do. And I think one of the bigger problems that we see, though, is a lot of folks are thinking that, well, you know, it's the government should fix this, right? I mean, somebody from outside should come in and fix these problems that we're having with water quality, with the Barnegat Bay, you know, with the health of our waterways. In reality, we all have to do our part. And every homeowner can take a little bit of action and do something that's going to be important and make a difference. And I think that's one piece that we have to try to get across to people. Maybe we need to start with the kids because some of the adults are already jaded. Maybe they can't learn anything new. But you know, right now, we might want to start with the middle school kids too, because high school kids seem to be pretty set in their ways. So I think we're thinking a lot about trying to educate youth too as part of this. So
those are the things that, you know, we need to sort of like gravitate to, you know, and you know, that NOAA report that I had referred to previously, the third national risk assessment that was put out by NOAA, I think it was just this year or maybe last year, but in any event, you know, they talk about the importance of minimizing runoff, addressing minor flooding, and doing that using, you know, green infrastructure, stormwater management techniques. And, you know, that's my mantra has always been when it comes to stormwater, is to think of runoff as a resource, you know, just as you had mentioned, Avery. And rather than, you know, think about how do we get rid of this as quickly as possible, you know, how do we embrace it? How do we keep it on site? And, you know, look for ways to use it either in a positive way or manage it in a way that doesn't just push the problem downstream, you know, to your neighbor or the neighboring, you know, community. And, you know, I think that's been the big message both Chris and I have tried to get across, starting with homeowners themselves. Here's things that you can do on your own, and then sort of like leading up to, you know, community, let's call them representatives, you know, people that are on planning boards and township committees and things along those lines. And then even, you know, higher up into state legislation and legislators, and then even at the federal government level. But it all begins really, as Chris pointed out, at the homeowner level. And that means education, outreach. And then, you know, not only with education and outreach, but providing them with examples showing that this stuff does work. And there's a lot of examples. We have data now going back easily into the 1990s, you know, showing how green infrastructure, when done on that small localized scale, does have a really big positive impact. So, you know, I think as Chris says, you need to get the message out. You need to really drill into people's heads that they have the ability to correct some of these problems. And it starts at the home level. And, you know, and granted, I mean, we can't manage the 100-year storm. We can't manage the storm of record. But just think about it. How many times you hear on the radio that there's going to be a 1-inch rain or 1.5 inches of rain, and there's going to be a lot of flooding? Well, those storm events are relatively small. They don't even equate to what is considered the 1-year event. So, you know, doing something with these smaller storms keeping that runoff on site has a real big positive effect.
Well, and I think it's important to point out when Steve says keep the water on site, he doesn't mean to store it in your basement. He's talking about storing it in the landscape and in the lawns and in the soil, you know, and even, you know, everybody should have a rain barrel, you know, to collect that water and be able to water their plants inside their house and you know, use to wash their cat or, you know, what they're going to use it for, you know. So everybody should have one of those at their house. And it's a pretty easy thing to get and put in place.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, you know, we're lucky here in the Northeast and in New Jersey because we're pretty water rich, okay?
Yeah.
We don't really deal that much with droughts. We have had droughts, but we don't, that's not something that's common. But if you, you know, if you look out west, you'll see there's more of this push towards, as Chris is, you know, mentioning, getting that runoff, keeping it on site, putting it back down into the ground, recharging, you know, surficial and even deeper aquifers. And, you know, it's recognized that, you know, that is something that's needed to combat drought. But at the same time, it's something that can be done to combat flooding as well.
Well, people don't realize that 50% of the water we use in the state comes from groundwater. It's pumped out of the ground.
Yeah.
Right. So we really need to get water back into the ground to supply those, you know, agricultural wells or even drinking water wells that we use to pipe water to our homeowners in our state.
Right. Yeah, you know, when Chris and I have advocated and really try to push this concept that with these smaller storms, like the one-year storm, which is still a significant amount of rainfall, that's 2.75 inches of rain over 24 hours. If I can retain all of that, the runoff from a storm of that magnitude on my property, okay, I've already started to mitigate about 93% of all the flooding events that you have on a yearly basis. I mean, that's, you know, and it doesn't take a lot to do that. As Chris pointed out, rain barrels, small rain gardens, vegetated swales, all the things that DEP has been promoting now, you know, as part of the green infrastructure approach to managing stormwater runoff. Unfortunately, you know, it's been a slow process to get people to adapt and accept. And I think, as you know, Chris mentioned, I think, you know, a lot of people are jaded. Unfortunately, this was politicized, and that is unfortunate because, you know, stormwater management isn't a political thing. It's a human resource thing. So, you know, it's something though that we can do. It's in our grasp, and it's something that can be accomplished.
So you guys have done a great job so far of kind of alluding to the definition of green infrastructure, but I just want to make it super clear to our listeners what green infrastructure is, how different kinds of green infrastructure should be selected depending on the type of soil. So in Barnegat Bay Watershed, we of course have a lot of folks that live on the barrier islands, Barnegat Island and Long Beach Island. And then as we move west towards the you know, headwaters of our rivers, creeks, and streams, the soil is still very sandy, which drains water really well and doesn't support an enormous plant community, right? There's only a select few that can kind of live in these conditions.
I mean, I can start with sort of like a general interpretation of both the US EPA and New Jersey DEP's definition of green infrastructure. And it's a very adaptable term. Okay, so you're talking about a pretty wide array of various types of products and the technologies and even practices that at the end of the day, what you're trying to do is use both natural systems and engineered systems to manage runoff. Okay, and what does that boil down to? It boils down to like the use of vegetation, soils, and the ability to collect runoff, allow it to infiltrate, lose some of it through evapotranspiration, or even recycle it in some manner, you know, beneficial reuse. But what we're talking about is really stormwater management systems that mimic nature by soaking up and storing runoff. So, you know, that is, you know, sort of like the general approach. And you can see it's a pretty wide loose definition, but I think that is sort of like the goal of green infrastructure, to kind of use nature to our benefit. And it's going to vary from, like, it, you know, as you mentioned, from location to location based on site conditions.
So, I mean, one of the best ways I think to describe it, Steve, is that, you know, stormwater management as we know it today is we build a 50 lot subdivision, and that last lot at the bottom of the hill we make into a big detention basin. So the big basin that's filled with grass and has a concrete channel in it. And the idea is the stormwater runs off of those houses and those roadways and picks up all the pollution from the land, carries it down and goes into that basin. And that basin holds that water and lets it out slowly. It does very little to filter the water, does very little to allow the water to infiltrate into the ground. It's really not a great system to improve water quality and to really try to restore that natural water cycle that we have. Because as we develop the land, we've increased the amount of runoff and we reduce the amount of infiltration. And that's where we really kind of turned our natural water cycle into this urban water cycle. Mm-hmm. So what green infrastructure does is it tries to restore that by putting these practices closer to the source. So instead of waiting for the water to run down the hill, why not capture it off your downspout or off the end of your driveway or closer to where it lands before it becomes stormwater runoff and picks up pollution? We often say that green infrastructure practices, there's five different kind of functions that they serve. One is infiltration. So they capture water and they infiltrate it, let it soak back into the ground. Another one's filtration, where they have these mechanisms that plants is water's passing through the plants. It's filtering out some of the pollution. Another mechanism is storage. So it can store the water and hold it for reuse later on. And then we have evaporation. So some will hold the water and let it evaporate back into the atmosphere. And the last one's transpiration. Transpiration is a little bit hard to describe. It's like for people, we would consider it perspiration. We drink, we sweat, and we let water out, goes out of our pores. Well, transpiration is that the plants are taking up water from the ground and it's releasing it through its leaves. Some green infrastructure practices have all five of these functions. Some only have one. But the whole goal of this really is to put smaller systems in, put them closer to the source of water, and really try to restore that natural water cycle, try to get more water back into the ground and reduce the amount of water that's running off. If we can do that, we can go a long way to solving a lot of the water problems we have in this state.
Yeah, and Chris brings up a really good point. I think at the beginning, you know, of the podcast, he mentioned the fact that there's still about 80% of the nation's waters that are impaired, and they're impaired because of non-point source pollution. And, you know, we've had in New Jersey since 1985, 1986, a stormwater rule, okay? But that stormwater rule, even now, focuses primarily on controlling the rate of runoff. And that's why we still see these big basins, these centralized basins, what I call like an end of the pipe solution. But my point is that if we still have all these impaired waters and we've been doing stormwater management, you know, using this centralized basin approach, it's got to tell you something that that's not the correct solution. The correct solution is to try to manage that runoff as close to its point of generation as possible, as Chris mentioned, put it back down into the ground, let the plants, let the soil do their thing to, assimilate pollutants. And then that is far more successful as opposed to just storing runoff for a given amount of time, and then releasing it downstream. You haven't reduced the volume, so there's still flooding, and you haven't done much in the way of reducing pollutants. So there's still the water quality problems. So yeah, we know we need to do better, but still it's been slow to get people to really, accept this approach.
So getting back to your original question, about the soils, and tying it back to that and the Barrier Islands and the Barnegat Bay watershed. The sandy soils are ideal for infiltrating water into the ground, but they're often not very ideal for growing plants, so you have to be very careful on your plant selection. You may have to amend the soil a little bit to enhance the organic content to get the plants to grow. But you really do need some space for that water that you're pushing back into the ground, you're letting seep into the ground. It's got to have a place to go. So if the groundwater table is high, it's very difficult to do that. So you have problems on the Barrier Islands trying to infiltrate water. So a lot of cases we want to maybe be storing water instead for reuse and those kind of things, as opposed to trying to infiltrate it into the ground because the water table is so high already there. We see right now, we see a lot throughout New Jersey during the spring tide, when we have a full moon during high tide, We get a lot of roadways are flooding out along the Jersey Shore and along the Delaware Bay. So we have to begin thinking about when it rains during those time periods, where's that water going to go? And we need to begin thinking about where can we store it till low tide comes and we can release it. So we have to hold it for, you know, 5-6 hours until we're able to release it into the bay or into the ocean. So those are things that we have to think a little bit more about. And also we have to be very careful when we're building these gardens. We don't want to add too much organic material, too much compost, because that compost itself has nutrients in it that can leach out of the garden, go into the groundwater table, and eventually make its way to the bay. So we may be building a rain garden in Manchester or Tom's River. And if we had a lot of organic content, we may be having impact on the bay 5 or 10 years after we build that garden, when the groundwater actually makes its way to the bay, because it gets there very, very slowly. So we have to be a little bit careful about that. So it's a little bit of a balancing act. And, you know, you really need to kind of understand what you're trying to do and seek out advice from some professionals to help you do that. You know, whether it's seeking out advice from Rutgers Cooperative Extension or private consultants like Steve. I know Steve's supposed to be semi-retired, but I'm sure he's got plenty of time. You'd always give a call. I'll give you his cell phone number. Just contact him.
No, I mean, and that's a really good point, though, Chris, because, you know, some people think of green infrastructure as, oh, you just dig a hole in the ground, you put some plants in there, and you walk away. But, you know, it definitely is more than that, because you, the plants, the soil, the hydrology all has to work together properly. And, you know, I'll make a pitch, you know, for Rutgers and for, you know, for Chris, but Rutgers has put out what I consider nationally probably one of the best rain garden manuals that you can get. And it's just fantastic in terms of not only identifying how to properly size and construct your rain garden, but, you know, some of the, you know, some of the things that need to be taken into account, as Chris is saying, depending on your soil type, maybe, you know, maybe you need to amend the soil a little bit, type of plants to use, et cetera. And I think DEP has sort of provided some pretty good guidance as well in the most recent update of the BMP manual. So, you know, there's some really good information in there as well, but it is more than just digging a hole in the ground and putting plants. I mean, you, as I mentioned before, you're really looking to get, you know, soils, plants, and hydrology all working in concert.
That lends itself to an interesting conversation, too, about how this is managed depending on where you are within the watershed and certainly across the state where it varies even more. I think that it's clear that infrastructure needs to be implemented and championed by private citizens and municipal leaders and local elected officials working together in concert to find the best solution for the specific hydrology, soil type, plant life of each town. And so that is something that I find particularly exciting about green infrastructure as a solution or a tool in managing stormwater across the state and in different places around the country. It's something that can be done quite locally and, in fact, should be done quite locally.
Yeah.
So big thanks to Chris and Steve for appearing on this episode. We really value hearing these expert voices. As we mentioned, stormwater, and I'm sure as you probably gathered, is a complex and often very complicated issue. But at its very foundation, it's something that affects us all as homeowners, as private citizens, as people who live in a town. We are trying to bridge these gaps of understanding. So coming up, we have some exciting things to continue this conversation on stormwater and bring more folks into the fold. So as I mentioned earlier, Chris and Steve are part of a seminar series on stormwater. It's called Charting a Course for Barnegat Bay Stormwater Series. The first one is coming up very soon on June 2nd. This will be a free workshop that's offered virtually on Zoom. Keep an eye out on our social medias. If you are on our email subscription list, you'll get an email about this with all the ways to sign up. They will be talking a little bit more about the stuff we mentioned in this episode today on green infrastructure and just kind of a primer on stormwater issues from a zoomed out lens. And then the series continues on June 21st, will be a second Zoom seminar. And this one is progressing even more into the stormwater conversation. And then the series concludes on July 21st with an in-person seminar taking place at Mill Creek Pavilion in Stafford Township. And again, you can keep an eye on our social medias, email, listservs, stuff like that to register for this. So this event is free, open to the public, especially encouraging folks from groups like green teams, municipal elected officials, public works, water operators, storm sewer operators. We have an opportunity through Rutgers University to give out one CEU or a continuing education unit for each seminar. If you have any questions or you have trouble finding how to get registered for all of that, you can email me. And my email is assistant@savebarnegatbay.org.
So if you're a resident in Ocean County and you're curious and want to go to those extra special workshops, you are more than welcome to go to them. But if you are a resident and homeowner, especially, and you're interested in going to a workshop where you can take home a thing for your yard that might help you manage your stormwater on your property, we are hosting rain barrel workshops throughout Ocean County. The Southern Watershed is getting 5 different workshops upcoming in the next 2 weeks, including Stafford, Little Egg Harbor, Barnegat, Tuckerton, and Eagleswood. And then next on deck that we are working on scheduling will be in Manchester, Lakehurst, and possibly one here at the Eco Center, but no promises on that. Stay tuned. There's so much going on, and there's a lot of resources that we're going to be sharing over the next few weeks via this podcast and our work with NEMO. So thank you for sticking with this episode. We know it's a lot. We look forward to hearing from you.
Until next time. Bye, everyone.
See ya.